Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And tonight we are going to venture into the world of something here, spiritualism. And my thoughts on tonight were to... I was going to read another essay by... Manly P. Hall, and we read The Search for the Unknown God last week, and I thought that was pretty, I enjoyed that essay very much. Tonight's essay is, I don't know if I want to get into this one. I thought about it, but... I thought this one might be more for us tonight. Interested me, actually. It's called The Mystery of the Middle Path That Leads to the End of Suffering. That's Lecture 165 by Manly P. Hall. Copyright 1972 and through the Philosophical Research Society. And... I thought we might see where this leads us tonight. I think it might be interesting. It's called The Mystery of the Middle Path That Leads to the End of Suffering. It's a lecture by Manly P. Hall. And it starts out, as the problems of the contemporary scene intensify, and promise to continue for some time to be a burden upon human consciousness, the search for a solution also has been intensified. More than ever before, we are thinking of how to live well in this complex pattern. Until recently, we took it for granted that the world was going to provide us with personal security. We depended heavily upon the advancements in that knowledge and philanthropy, feeling that we were protected by a system of government, which was highly paternalistic. The individual, having very few responsibilities which he felt himself required to carry, has turned from his duties to his pleasures, and under the freedom of the present patterns, has dedicated his life essentially to the fulfillment of his own desires. And that pretty much sets the stage for where we're at right now in contemporary life, even though this was written 35 years ago. We are aware that government cannot bestow peace of mind upon its citizens. No government ever has succeeded in doing this, or probably ever will. I have to check this out. Well, anyway, we are still on... call come through here that I thought was important, but let me continue. The integrities that we need must come from within ourselves rather than from the environment. We are beginning to recognize that we must become stronger as individuals, depending upon our own resources for those comforts and consolidation and consolations which seem so immediately necessary, for in the past few years, nearly all the outside crops have been knocked away. We have lost the support of collective morality. Our friends and neighbors are not living in a way that inspires us to live better. We have lost the support and strength of scientific progress, which becomes more confusing and frightening every day and seems to threaten our survival. Religion, too, has been very heavily undermined to the average person. The old faiths are not sufficient, but the modernization of a religion has been in the keeping largely of the person seeking self-satisfaction rather than the common good of mankind. Our religion has lost its authority as a moral directive in the lives of many people, especially in the Western Hemisphere. And although there is evidence of a great deal of individual thinking in the field, we are experiencing an interval in which the securities of sectarianism are lost and the securities of conscious endeavor to understand are not strong enough to support us until this trend toward self-improvement has developed more fully. One of the influences which results in the problem we have today, on all levels, is Western man's concept of the universe. Although it is not to be assumed that we can master all the secrets of the infinite, it is true that we are in need of a generality, a workable hypothesis that can support our spiritual needs with a sense of more or less adequate morality. In Western philosophy for the past 2,000 years, the tendency has been to ignore the validity of natural laws. For a long time, certainly throughout the Dark Ages and into the later medieval period, natural laws are largely unknown, and when they are known, they are disregarded. We recognize that nature was a magnificent structure of some kind, but look upon it simply as an environment in which we could live approximately as we pleased. That the universe might be demanding of us was a thought that did not exist in the vision of time. With the rise of science and modern economics, we moved from this point of view into that of technological agnosticism. As a result of this approach to life, we have come down to the present time without realizing that we had any regular curbs upon our actions and feeling we could get away with almost anything. We believe that the universe was a vast plateau upon which planets, cities, and worlds were established and left to their own devices. The magnificent force that moved all things was conceived of as a kind of non-intelligent electricity, which merely fulfilled certain mechanistic functions and kept the machinery running. Now, however, when we consider an automobile, we realize that while it is made up of inanimate parts, it helps us to sustain morality, thereby teaching us a great deal if we want to learn. If we neglect a car or abuse it, its usefulness will be impaired or destroyed. It begins to dawn on us that there are rules governing all things, and that the proper understanding of these rules is philosophy, the application of which is science. And more than that, the honoring of these facts as infinite truths is, finally, religion. All of our ways of life must be based upon a lawful pattern of existence. 25 years ago in India, Gautama Buddha was the first to bring this point clearly to human attention. He built around it a great system of ethical philosophy that gradually unfolded into a religion. The whole concept is based upon the simple fact that we live in a lawful world in which there are things we must do, things we must not do, and certain other things in which we have a limited determinism. If we keep the rules, we can live as we please, almost. If we break the rules, we must abide by the consequences of our mistakes. Our pleasures become fewer, and our miseries increase. It is amazing that this idea could have developed so far back in history without anyone in the ensuing 2,500 years realizing that this is the philosophy that is demonstrated by history. Almost every experience of man supports this point of view, and man is reluctant to admit that there is any authority in life greater than his own self-will. After the number of emergencies that have arisen lately, all of which are traceable to errors in conduct or judgment bound to man's selfishness, it is becoming more obvious that the ideals of long ago were essentially correct. We live in a world which has rules of its own. These rules are basically ethical and moral, and the man who tries to avoid them is soon in difficulty. The simplest example, perhaps, is the human body itself. It is not simply a convenience. It is an instrument suitable for our purposes and useful to for a considerable period of time. But if we break the rules of the body, in order to advance some purpose of our own, disaster follows. And the body has rules, the earth has rules, all institutions that men build have laws inherent to them. Everything that is created within a pattern of laws, and these laws must be obeyed. It is therefore inevitable that we be faced sometime with the need to think that this through clearly. Actually, our task is not especially difficult. It is simply the person moving his faith away from the uncertainties of the day, and perhaps from the inability of himself to solve all his problems, and placing it squarely upon natural law, as the reflection is reflection in matter of divine law, and building a life in obedience to what is obviously the will of the infinite. This will is not theological. It is essentially naturalistic. It tells us how to live and carries within itself a sense of purpose and plan. These are very important factors. In a universe that knew nothing and was going nowhere, it would be comparatively futile for any human being to create a plan. Plans cannot be matured if everything is an accident, nor can even the most constructive planning be demonstrated unless there are forces in nature which will support the right plan and ultimately destroy the wrong one. One of the problems that always has concerned us is tomorrow. Where are we going? What does it all add up to? What lies beyond illusion? What are we facing beyond nuclear fission, beyond the uncertainties of the present economic pattern? As individuals, as groups, as nations, where are we going? Are we going to continue forever in a strange confusion of dog-eat-dog policies, or is there a real reason for our existence? If so, can we discover it? If we cannot discover it, can we at least experience the pressures in life which are moving us toward that discovery? Are we able to cooperate constructively with emotions or real progress, or are we going to be burdened eternally with false and futile struggles against a seemingly insurmountable obstacle? In reality, the insurmountable obstacle is simply the fact that what is not done according to nature cannot be done successfully. Any such effort may seem to succeed for a while, but ultimately it will fail because it does not contain the sustaining power of the universal purpose. Let us not attempt to decide what that purpose is other than to recognize that all things in nature are moving toward a betterness and a fulfillment of potential. Somewhere in this process lies the growth that we hope to achieve, in the better world that we hope to build. In the meantime, our primary problem is our own relationship to life as we find it today through our own personal experience. One of our difficulties here in the West is our absorption in trivia. We are completely tied up in non-essentials and desperately concerned with things of small importance, simply because they seem to add to our comfort and material security, or to fulfill ambitions and desires. As the result of being so involved in the gratification of our sensory perceptions, we have little or no time for any other type of thinking. If by accident it does rise, we discard it immediately because it interferes with the continued thrust of our ambition. As a result of our present condition, when we are a very, very tired world, we have become so involved in the continued fulfillment of largely unimportant purposes that we do not have the energy, time, or background qualifications for some good, straight mental effort. Probably the only way in which a solution will be found is for the individual and the world to be placed in an economic situation in which thinking becomes mandatory to survival. We know that quietude, relaxation, peace of mind, and diversification of interests are all necessary for sound judgment. They are essential to the handling of our affair with dignity, with dignity. And several systems of philosophy, both Eastern and Western, have had something to say about the cultivation of internal quietude. The one who spoke the loudest in the West was Socrates. He believed that the survival of man depends upon not upon attaining what he wants, but upon reducing his wants. The individual can never escape from the complex of nervous pressure unless his desires grow less. Today, the more the individual has, the more his desires expand. so that he never will catch up with his vision of what he needs. And Socrates declared that man to be the richest whose personal needs are fewest, because as the individual escapes from the tyranny of his own desires, he moves closer and closer to the dignity of his own humanity. And when he is free from pressures that make him a slave to things, he becomes a free man. Until then, he is a serf. Socrates also emphasized the wisdom of moderation. He said, "In all things, not too much." Certainly, we would not have advised the individual to walk out of society and live as a refugee from responsibility. We would not have taught the individual to become an indigent, evading his proper duties and expecting someone else to carry his responsibilities. What Socrates advised was that the person take stock of his real needs, coming gradually to realize that the most important things in life are not the most expensive. Things that are really fine are those that develop within the nature of the person. We can live quietly, moderately, and within his means, devoting part of his energy to the enlargement of his own understanding and the enrichment of his life and character. Confucius advocated the same philosophy. His idea of a superior man, the true hero of the world, his equivalent to Nietzsche's Superman, was never envisioned as being rich. The Superman was the individual whose character was superior, and all superiority lay in the attainment of values, not in material possessions. These always tempt the individual away from his own superiority, luring him into compromises that lead to qualms of conscience and difficulties with others. To Confucius's mind, the superior man was the poet, the artist, the scholar, the individual who gathered with a few selected friends in the bamboo grove to discuss eternal realities. He was a person whose inner life so disciplined his outer conduct that it was impossible for him to perform an unworthy act. This is true superiority. It is non-competitive, something that the person gains within the pattern of his own ability. It is perfectly possible for the person of very humble attainments to be superior, just as it is also possible for a person of very great attainments to be inferior. The Buddha, in his doctrine of moderation and the noble path that leads to this end of suffering, also emphasizes this point and brings it home with a variety of extraordinarily apt examples and parables. It is most important that the individual find the solution for those problems which make him miserable. There is no proof that nature really wants man to be miserable. What nature wants for him is to be a gracious citizen, respecting the life within himself and others and honoring the universal life under which he lives. Nature does not wish to humiliate man. Men humiliate one another in the ruthless advancement of their purposes. Nature wants everyone to be honorable and honored, if they so deserve. And this concept is exemplified in Buddhist teachings as the middle way. The middle way is that in which the person follows a simple, quiet road which he sees winding before him up to the top of a great mountain, where perhaps it becomes obscured in the haze that so often clings to a mountaintop. The road leads from where the person stands to where he must go, regardless of his own desires. Along the road, there can be seen many small roads branching off. They go to various places. Each is clearly marked, but each is a kind of blind alley. They might seem to offer a pleasant rest, a vacation, or a temporary pause in the struggle for survival, but these hundreds and thousands of byways that cross and crisscross, all leading away from the main road, can become a hopeless maze. An individual who loses sight of the highway by traveling these paths may wander the rest of his days without ever getting back to the main road. All these paths lead to some sort of gratification, which often is followed by disaster. At best, this promise also transitory pleasures which end as burdens. The moment one of these pleasures is experienced, it no longer is satisfying. And somewhere in this maze of twisting paths, he comes to the end of his life. Or rather, and I'm sorry, it is no longer as satisfying, and the pleasure seeker tries another road to see whether he will have greater success. Somewhere in this maze of twisting paths, he comes to the end of his life, and nearly all of us are now on byways. We have not considered the importance of the main road, yet the main road is the only one which actually leads to a purposeful goal. The Buddha tells us that these byways are dominated very largely by appetite impulses. The individual leaves the middle road in search of a glamorous mirage, which he pursues into the desert of sorrow and suffering. It requires sensitive integrity to meet the situation, and a little thoughtfulness on the part of us all. What we are really talking about is self-control, the power to assert more and more character in dealing with circumstances. The individual can begin to release himself from confusion by gradually relinquishing those circumstances which cause the greatest confusion. Moderation is the answer. It is not to turn our backs upon the experiences of living, but to bring them within the integrity of our own understanding. We can safely handle what we understand. What we do not understand is a threat to us. We can understand those parts of life which we are familiar, and we can strengthen and improve our understanding until it is serviceable to us. Things in themselves are not the real problem. The office building downtown that is not quite making its cost, the taxes on the home which are becoming exorbitant, the rise in the cost of living, these are not the problem. We think they are, but they are not. The real problem is our own inability to handle the circumstances that arise. The moment the outside problem becomes so powerful that it disturbs our internal peace, we are in difficulty. The only way we can meet the situation is either to handle it more intelligently or to simplify the situation themselves at the expense of some profit or ambition of our own. A man who is having a great deal of trouble trying to work out his indebtedness will meet another man who is equally in debt, but who has quietly worked out his problem. Although both may owe the same amount, one man is in panic and the other has found a solution which ultimately will free him from his debt. The difference is not in what he is owed, but in the attitude of the person to his debt. Everywhere we see other people handling conditions which we cannot seem to cope with successfully. They, in turn, may see us doing better in some matters than they. It is how we handle our problems that is important. The way to handle our problems is to increase our own internal integrity. As we become wiser, our tastes, appetites, and ambitions will change. By degrees, the torments which have arisen in us because of poor understanding will resolve themselves. We will find happiness in solution, whereas we had found happiness only in creating the debt. All of the points involved come finally to moderation of our own living patterns. Here, the Oriental mind seemingly has coped successfully with the situation over a long period of time. For over 5,000 years, the Oriental mind has, in general, held a perspective completely different from ours, which is turned directly toward the building of an external culture. We want to be the largest, the best, and the richest. We want to be in continuous competition with each other. If one city grows, another city wants to grow bigger. If the individual creates a great economic structure of $10 billion, someone else immediately is going to try for $15 billion. And everything is highly pressured and competitive. And almost every direction of this procedure is completely physical. All these projects will end either with the passing of the person or by the failure of the project itself, which becomes so overburdened and top-heavy that it collapses from its own weight. And there's Madoff, the Madoff fortune. Facing your karma, pal. And we are, therefore, confronted with the problem that here in the West, everything is measured in terms of material prosperity and gratification. For some reason, Eastern philosophy never developed this attitude. Various explanations have been advanced for this difference from climate to soil to radical background or racial background to the miseries of the political situations that have arisen throughout the centuries. However, the one factor seems to be that the Asiatic mind has been concerned primarily with external rather than externals, rather eternals rather than externals. This does not necessarily mean that he has not been successful in solving all problems, but the Oriental realizes that we are citizens of a world larger than the material one which we see, and that we are going to live here for only a short time, whereas we will live in the universe forever. Therefore, universals come first. An individual who is studying for a profession at the present time is not going to spend his time studying one that has no future. He is not going to learn at this stage of our civilization how to make a better buggy whip, because nobody is going to use it, even if it does make it. He does make it. And why, then, should we put all our emphasis upon a career which extends only from our early 20s to our Social Security days? Why put everything we have into that which is temporary career at best, and pay absolutely no attention to our universal citizenship, which may extend over a period of a billion years? We are tying ourselves to something that has no future. Even though we must live as comfortably and securely as possible while we are here, obsession with being here and with achieving is foolish. Not only is it exhausting to our resources, but it takes our attention entirely away from the essential reason for life, and that is personal growth, not the building of industrial empires. Asia saw this, and for thousands of years we considered Asia to be superstition-ridden. We assumed that the Asians enjoyed wandering around in a state of poverty when they should have been miserable under the circumstances. And they wonder why we are miserable in a state of wealth when, by our own admittance, we should be happy. It is just a difference of perspective. The facts are obvious. The individual is here. What he is doing belongs here, and when he leaves here, it is finished. No one knows from day to day when he will leave. Therefore, it is short-sighted to build completely a policy which drenches the world in hundreds of wars just to advance temporal ambition, conquering this country and that, when no man is able to conquer for eternity the plot of his own grave. Not that man must become gloomily fatalistic, but he should develop something inside himself besides illusions. Quietly, moderately, and with good purpose, he can begin to understand something of himself, finally coming to learn that his own attitude, bound into the complex pattern of his present way of life, is the enemy with which he must cope. Nothing man suffers from is essentially other than the consequence of bad thinking, either individually or collectively. What is making people miserable is that he is trying to build a philosophy of life with the aid of a group of faculties which he never has matured enough to be able to judge what is good philosophically of life. He is trying to rely upon a misinterpretation of his experiences in order to gain the integrity necessary to live well. Because he cannot do this, he falls back again and again into the old mistakes, and these bind him to his world of difficulties. The Buddha pointed out the essential value of reducing comparatively meaningless activities. The primary reason for the individual being here is to grow. Anything that interferes with growth will not be long sustained by nature. Any action that keeps man small while he tries to make other things big will ultimately fail him. The real reason we are here is to unfold the humanity in ourselves to be a brother, a pleasant, gracious creature capable of beautiful thinking. The world has indeed produced some magnificent human beings, but they are very few, and nearly all of them have been persecuted by foolish people. The golden age we look for is an age of simple friendliness without aggressive competition. Friendship brings peace of mind. Ulterior motives destroy friendship. When we can trust friends and neighbors, when we recognize the integrities in our children, and the children recognize integrities in us, we will know that we are breaking through our terrible confusion into the kind of life we were supposed to live in the first place. We have been away from the facts so long that it is not going to be easy to retrace our steps. It seems as if everyone is waiting for the sky to open up in a magnificent spiritual revelation to inspire us in the right direction. It is not the sky which must open, but rather our own hearts, for locked in these hearts is the key to the whole situation. The individual has to begin to unfold his own potential. For examples of the lives graciously lived, we can look around us at all the various arts, crafts, trades, and professions. They all can be beautiful, revealing the mystery of the middle path that leads to the end of suffering. The right use of knowledge does not hurt. The wrong use kills. The right dedication makes people great and happy. Wrong dedication must find a way to move this foundation from the shaky basis upon which it stands today to the immovable base deep within its own character. Meditation, then, is a kind of door opening into another dimension of life. Here in the West, most people are skeptical about meditation because they think it is stultifying ambition, taking away their driving determination to accomplish all they can regardless of the feelings of other people. If this is the real goal of life, then to change will not be a happy experience. But the very process of changing alters the point of view. As we grow wiser, we find wiser ways of being happy. This we all must do someday. Meditation takes us from a world of noise to a world of eternal quietude, where we learn the strength of quietude. We learn that the noise is of our own making and that quietude is the peace of heaven, which we were permitted to share in if we have the right attitude. The moment of peace during meditation provide an opportunity to recognize realities. How truly wonderful it is not to be disturbed, not to be bound to an erratic, eccentric attachment or competitive. Meditation can lead in the case of the Buddhist arhats to citizenship in a larger universe. It can cause the thoughtful person to realize the nature of real strength, not the power of overcome disaster. But that discipline within ourselves, which prevents the disaster from arising. Strength is forever preventing mistakes instead of struggling through them at a tremendous waste of energy. Meditation also shows us how to conserve resources, helping us to improve the functions of living as of the body. Gradually, it causes us to live in a world above pettiness, arguments, revenge, and jealousy. It shows us a universe of infinite life, wisdom, and love existing everywhere, forever, a vision of the land of our origin. In some mysterious way, we came from this peace, and we must find it again, exchanging turmoil for the quietude of conviction. This does not mean that we must gradually depart from this life in order to live as meditation directs. Meditation can become the source of daily liberation, wherein the individual simply refuses to be aggressive. He becomes a spiritual pacifist, so to speak, without compromising his principles in any way. This is not a compromise, but simply the ability of the individual to be larger than his problem. When he is larger than the problem, there is no impact, no bitter warning. It is only when he is smaller than the problem that he becomes belligerent. And after meditation, many problems simply fade away. We are part of an impermanent, a pattern that must pass away. So why make an issue of it? Try always to keep the rules and the laws, and for the rest be kind. If you will follow this thinking, you will begin to simplify living. You will lose interest in doing things that must be done at the expense of others. You will lose satisfaction in the winning of an argument, which actually is nothing less than a small storm in the atmosphere in which you live. All this is part of the path that leads to the end of suffering. No one who causes pain can be free from pain, and no one whose conduct deserves misery can be free from misery, and no one who for any reason whatsoever inflicts cruelty upon another can be free from karma. These evils must cease. The cruel world, the vengeful act, arrogance, egotism, and self-centeredness must cease to be, or man will continue to pay the terrible price he pays today. If the individual feels a need for destructive, aggressive expression, he must expect the cause he sets in motion to come back and work misery upon himself. Suffering only ends when we cease to cause it, and this is true only of the suffering we cause other people, but of the suffering we cause ourselves. By living in a mental or emotional world in which we torture ourselves with our own attitudes, we again set up a karma that must be reckoned with. A destructive individual will face some form of destruction in his own life. In order to arrive at the end of the path of suffering, he must quietly put away the causes of suffering. These causes arise from ignorance of the law of life. The ignorant person cannot prevent suffering because he does not know the law governing right conduct. Thus, evil arises from ignorance. No selfish person is enlightened regardless of our attainments in letters and arts. If we are capable of causing suffering and are even rather proud of having done so, we are abysmally ignorant, not only in terms of the immediate result, but in terms of the collective society and history for the destiny of the world. Ignorance creates selfishness. Selfishness creates sorrow, and sorrow ends in suffering. While selfishness exists, there is no end to suffering. When selfishness ceases, suffering ends also. Selfishness seems to be so intrinsically part of our way of life that we do not even realize what we are doing, and everything is interrupted in terms of advantage to ourselves, of pleasure, of gratification for ourselves. When this attitude gets out of hand and people grow tired of being its victims, we begin to lose friends, and without friends, we become neurotic. Now, I got to repeat that. I said everything is interrupted in terms of advantage to ourselves, of pleasure and gratification for ourselves. When this attitude gets out of hand and people grow tired of being its victims, we begin to lose friends, and without friends we become neurotic. The source of almost every psychological ailment is selfishness. Man will have to keep on spending a fortune. On psychiatrists, just as long as he spends hundreds of hours of his life exploiting other people or trying to bend their lives to do his will. These habits are wrong, and the answer is to depart from them, expanding our understanding beyond them to the point where we value those things which are most immediately and eventually profitable in terms of good. Speech must be controlled because a great deal of sorrows come from words hastily spoken. From the spreading of slander and gossip, and from a tyrannical mind not well developed, but perhaps strongly effective, because of an excellent vocabulary. Many things uttered are false, and many efforts are made to force attitudes by means of fallacious words and arguments. But words hurt. The false accusations cause pain. The good book says, let your answers be or nay, nay. And I lost my place again. I'm sorry. The Bible says also, agree with thine adversary quickly while thou art in the way with him. The better course is to be constructive. In this way, we have the simple satisfaction of not having broken the code of truth within us or having broken the heart of someone else. And any word that is spoken hastily in hope of hurting someone or in revenge for a real or imagined grievance causes negative karma, which in turn causes suffering. We also have the question of right attitude toward life. The person should think largely in terms of the simple dignities of living. No individual who sets a bad example by conduct is free from guilt. The Buddha, therefore, admonishes his disciples, especially that in their daily contact with the people, they should be careful to live according to the principles of the Sangha or Brotherhood. If our deeds are not consistent with our words, we cause sorrow. And the person whose conduct is such that it contributes to the delinquency of others is building a very unfortunate future for himself. We must in every way try to live up to our principles. And one of the best guides for this is the Sermon on the Mount, in which most of the essential problems of human conduct are recognized and their proper solutions indicated. Another certainty is our moral responsibility to return good for evil. It is our responsibility to seek good in all that lives, rejoicing if we find it or blaming ourselves for lack of vision if we cannot find it. Also, according to the Eastern way of life, at least a small part of life should be devoted to the earnest search for integrities that will help us grow. Most of the great thoughts of the world today can be found in practical form suitable for study, and the great collections of paperback books bring some of the world's finest material to the public at reasonable prices, even under existing conditions. And some part of every day should be devoted to the sharing the great thoughts of those who have thought well. The person who is now glued to some miserable television production, which he has probably already seen several times, should instead spend half an hour every evening with the great hearts and souls who have contributed from the depths of their own understanding and love priceless gifts to man's consciousness. A little reading is all that is necessary. Too much can lead to a sorry intellectualism. The average man is not completely capable of discovering all the world's best thinking by his own experience. But when he reads words of wisdom, he can realize that his own subconscious was aware of truths that his conscious mind did not recognize at the time. Hold on, I gotta take a sip of water. Therefore, when somebody reads something that is very beautiful, he can say, I've always known that, but I didn't know how to express it. This is a common occurrence. Something beautifully said or written can draw out of us a magnificent surge of appreciation and reveal that in our consciousness, we also have this great thought, even though we are unable to put it into words. A little communion with the beautiful and the good can make life a richer experience. Some person can choose the type of book which is closest to his own interest, but there are certain great classics, great spiritual documents, which have stood the test of time and which always will be important. Although there may be many changes in the foundations of individual living, the larger eternal foundations will never change. Those who have recognized them have come to common agreement, giving us a possibility for right study, right thoughtfulness, and right contemplation of the things to be learned and experienced daily. The individual should also try to develop within himself some avenue for creative expression. The businessman and the pleasure seeker alike are constantly running away from the challenge of creativity, trying to find such substitutions for originality. True self-expression comes through art, music, poetry, and all the ways in which individuals release something from within themselves. As we grow older, release becomes especially important, and a dynamic interest can take the mind away from oneself when the mind is locked in the self. Sickness and suffering come more readily. The middle path is one of moderation, whereby the individual gradually feels himself from unreasonable and unnecessary involvement, simplifying, ennobling, and adding to his life a higher dimension of consciousness, which tells him that he is part of a larger plan and that the God he worships is a God of peace, which he must worship in private. And God is to be experienced as an infinite quietude, so strong that nothing can disturb it, but so gentle and near that it is available to the smallest child. And man must learn to be moved by this eternal quietude centered in himself. In the core of himself, he is one with the infinite, and the infinite is eternal peace. By the cultivation of peace, man approaches the God in his own heart. To grow without the proddings of tragedy requires a conscious dedication to life. It is better to grow not as a result of disillusionment, but because of a gradually unfolding realization of what the world is about and living accordingly to that realization. Those who really make this adjustment resolve to stay on the middle path and live according to it. And because they have made life good here, they will find the secret of life everlasting. We are unfolding our immortality here, and by making sure that we are living the best we can in this life, we are keeping faith with the destiny for which we were intended. Between us and the inner realization of this is a veil so thin that even a moment of quietude may pierce it. And certainly, as we develop internal insight, we shall discover the world of peace. We are living in a clamorous world of quietude made by God. We're living in a clamorous world we ourselves have made. Let us search, therefore, industriously for that other world of quietude made by God and intended for all his creatures. For in that quietude lies also the joy of eternal insight and purpose. By keeping this in mind, we will stay on the middle path. And that was the middle path. The Mystery of the Middle Path that Leads to the End of Suffering by Manly P. Hall. And I don't know if I can discuss that any further tonight with you, but we still have about 10 minutes. If anybody would like to call or contribute to this discussion, and be grateful and welcomed. But the essence of this, from what I gained, and others could gain differently, but people have to remain humble, purposeful, devoted to, or committed to doing the right things in life. I'm not saying that. I mean, yes, this is the middle path, and it's a rough path that we take because it's impossible not to hate people. It's impossible not to, not to feel bad, not to feel bad about things or sad or joyful or whatever. But I think as long as we take each day in stride be grateful for that day, then we're good. Because, I mean, there's no way. I can't tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, I can tell you, I can do a tarot reading, I can do a psychic reading of sorts. We can say what's on our mind, but things vary and change. And we bring that change on ourselves. We get too drunk, or we get too stoned, or we get too involved, or too... the point where we can't even think straight, then of course what are we doing? We're escaping. We're escaping our responsibilities and our obligations. And by doing that, we're paying the ultimate penalty. We may be pleasured for a while, but if we overdo to the extent that we neglect our responsibilities in this world, then likewise what will happen is we'll lose everything that we've gained. Everything good that we've done will be lost. So we have to do all things in moderation and try to do the best that we can. I guess that's my motto. I mean, my motto in life is to try to do the best that I can. Hurting the fewest people. I mean, that's a change for me because I grew up, basically as a normal American guy who went to work and hustled and tried to hustle and, make a living. And that's what you do. And there are always people there trying to stop you from making a living. It's just trying to compete with you or trying to take over your business or take your idea or steal something or whatever. But, it may take a while, but by God, sometimes there's true karma. And if a man puts something out, he'll get something back, whatever that is that he gets out and whatever. In whatever spirit that something is done, then it's rewarded in kind. Kindness rewards kindness. Cruelty, begets cruelty. And that's a very difficult thing to imagine such cruelty to somebody. Why are you being cruel to another person? Is it because that person is cruel to you? Well, maybe. But being crueler to that person doesn't do anything. It just makes everybody angry and subordinate. Best thing is to be kind, be as kind as you can. But sometimes you have to be cruel in your kindness. You have to be disciplined. You have to tell the kid, no, you can't have that bottle of poison, or no, you can't have that whatever, and, because they don't know the difference, that it's killing them. And, and as we grow up, we all have our vices. I mean, everybody eats or drinks or smokes or something, sex or pornography or whatever our vice may be. Believe me, I've had them all, so it's not something that I think, except for heroin addiction or something, but I haven't had that, thank God. But, all of the frailties, all of the I had to face everything at one time or another, and still do. I still smoke cigarettes. I can't seem to quit that. I still, have a drink every so often, but very moderately. At one time, I enjoyed my a few beers a night, or a few beers here and there, and enjoyed a drink, but I stopped that. After I hit 50, I kind of calmed down, and I just decided to relax with that. So many things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I am probably the least qualified person to inspire anybody to quit a vice. I mean, it's, you know, but, you know, I can say that if the vice is killing you, or the vice, I should say, the vice is creating hell for you in some way, it may not be worth the pleasure that you're deriving from it. So you might want to consider quitting, especially if you have a severe addiction. Again, it's your life. It's not mine. I have a hard enough time just keeping up, trying to keep myself below a pack of cigarettes a day, and you know, whatever else that I try to restrain myself from doing. But anyway, we only got about 3 minutes left of the show, and I think I'm going to do. If there's nobody calling in, and if you listened, I thank you so much for listening to our show. I hope you enjoyed that that lecture by Manly P. Hall, and I hope that you tell your friends about it. And that's about all I can tell you tonight. I want to thank you so much for joining me. And tomorrow night, George Dixon will be with us, and we'll be talking about whatever we talk about, which will be fascinating, I'm sure. George is always a fascinating guest and a good friend. So if you're interested in the paranormal or interested in esoteric knowledge, please join us tomorrow. Even if you're not interested in that, we'll try to make you we'll try to make it interesting enough for you so that at least you can go, what the hell are these guys talking about? You know, or maybe we'll catch you on a star. But I want to thank you and have a pleasant evening.